Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Beatrice Russo with ID the Future, your guest host today, and I have the pleasure today to have on the show Stephen Meyer, Director of Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. Dr. Meyer is a philosopher of science, a former professor, and an author of the New York Times bestselling book, Darwin's Doubt. Welcome to the show, Dr. Meyer.
It's great to be with you, Beatrice.
Dr. Meyer, I know you gave a couple lectures at the summer seminar that were very intriguing, and I want to ask you about those first. Can you give us a summary of your first lecture and the main takeaway?
Yeah, you bet. I talked a bit about my book, Darwin's Doubt, and the argument of the book, which has kind of three main phases. The first argument is an examination of the fossil record, and it addresses a mystery I call the mystery of the missing fossil. I'm looking at the period in the history of life known as the Cambrian period, where there was an explosive radiation of new forms of animal life. And this was very abrupt in the fossil record, and the Cambrian explosion was characterized by a lack of discernible ancestors in the lower Precambrian strata. So on a Darwinian view of the history of life, you'd expect to see a pattern that would look something like a branching tree, where the complex forms of animal life would have arisen from simpler precursors in the lower Precambrian strata. We don't see those ancestral forms. Instead, we see this a pattern of abrupt appearance. And so I addressed that issue. What's going on here? I suggested that it's a problem for standard forms of evolutionary theory today, not just Darwin's theory back in 1859. And then I segue to the second and deeper problem, which is the problem of the origin of the new information that would be needed to build those new forms of animal life. So the first mystery that I just discussed was the mystery of the missing fossils. The second one is the mystery that you might call, or the question you might ask, how to build an animal, or how would the evolutionary process build an animal in the time available, given the complexity of the systems that arose, these multicellular animal forms with complex organs, for example. And I looked in that section of the lecture at the different mechanisms that have been proposed by evolutionary theorists to explain the origin of form and showed why, for various reasons, these are insufficient, in particular showing that each lacked the creative power to generate the information, both the information in DNA, the genetic information, and what we now also refer to as the epi or ontogenetic information, the structural forms of information that are necessary for animal development. And I showed that evolutionary theory has a really profound problem on its hands with respect to the origin of form and the origin of information. And then in the last third of the lecture, I discussed the positive case for intelligent design, showing that based on our uniform and repeated experience of cause and effect, we know of only one cause which is sufficient to generate new forms of information. In particular, that cause is intelligence. I argued that whenever we see information, whether we see it in a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or a section of software code, and we trace that information back to its source, we always find a mind, not a material process. And so I argued that the big infusions of information we see in the fossil record that are necessary to build these new forms of life are actually evidence of the activity of a designing intelligence in the history of life. And so that was the overall structure of the lecture, and I addressed a lot of student questions afterwards, all of which were very good. So it was a really stimulating morning. I think we had about 2 hours for the session.
That's great. Thank you for that. I remember that lecture with a lot of, I really enjoyed it. So thank you for that. I wanted to ask you more also about the second lecture that you gave as well, if you can give us a brief summary and your main point.
Right. Well, the second lecture was a lecture about cosmology, and it is based on some work I've been doing now on my new book, and also some work I've been doing with Bruce Gordon and Brian Miller on issues in the philosophy of physics. The lecture followed a previous lecture by Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez about the new Big Bang cosmology. No longer so new, but you know the Big Bang cosmology that came into vogue in the 20th century, where the evidence from astronomy, observational astronomy, pointed to a beginning to the universe. The universe seems to be expanding outward from an initial singularity. And Jay and Guillermo talked about the evidence for that beginning point. I built on that by talking about some developments in theoretical physics in particular the singularity theorems of Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose and George Ellis from the 1960s and 70s, in which they proved that if general relativity is correct and applies to the universe, that we can establish that there was in fact a singular beginning to the universe. Hawking had this great insight in the 1960s when he was a PhD student that if the universe is expanding outward in the forward direction of time and matter is getting more and more diffuse, if we were to wind the clock backwards in the reverse direction of time, the matter would become more and more concentrated. And Hawking, who was also aware of Roger Penrose's work on black holes, knew that according to general relativity, as matter gets more densely concentrated, space will get more tightly curved. And so as he back extrapolated in his mind's eye, he realized that eventually the curvature of space would go to a limit. It would become infinitely tightly curved at some point in the past, marking the beginning of the universe. Mm-hmm. Now, that has a profound implication. It seems to suggest the need for a cause beyond the universe to bring the universe into existence. And on the basis of Hawking's result, as well as the evidence from observational astronomy about the redshift and the expanding universe, the classical Kalam cosmological argument has been revived among a lot of different philosophers, William Lane Craig in particular. So I took that kind of as the starting point of the lecture and then looked at a loophole in that argument that's been acknowledged or suggested by a number of physicists, and that is that general relativity, we know, applies way back to the beginning until the universe is incredibly tiny. And when the universe gets tiny enough, it would be describable by quantum physics. At that point, we might need a new theory of gravity. So say many of the theoretical physicists, they call that the theory of quantum gravity. And so then I looked at some of those theories of quantum gravity and showed that they too have theistic implications, though the implications are different, or rather the basis of the implications are different. And so I explored that, showing that even if you get around the idea that the universe had a definite beginning, and you can describe the origin of the universe as a consequence of the math of quantum physics, the idea that the universe, the material universe, could come out of math is itself an idea that's fraught with philosophical implications, because math is an idea. It resides in minds. And as one of the quantum cosmologists, Alexander Vilenkin, pointed out, if we're talking about the universe coming out of the equations or the universal wave function, it's called the mathematics of quantum theory, then are we really therefore talking about the universe coming from a mind? Because math is a conceptual reality that always exists in a mind. So I explored that possibility a bit. And then also showed that in order to solve the math of the quantum equations, you have to have an input of information, what are called the specification of boundary constraints, and that input always comes from the theoretical physicist. So in order to explain the origin of the universe from math alone, you first have to solve a prior mathematical equation that can't be solved unless there's an input of information. And in the modeling, that information always comes from a mind. So I suggested that even if this quantum cosmological approach is the correct approach, even if it does model what the universe was like or how it came into existence before general relativity could take over and describe the expansion of the universe, that these quantum cosmological models themselves had implications that were supportive of a kind of Platonic idealism and even a theistic design hypothesis where you have a mind generating the information that's necessary to specify the outcomes that give us our universe. Heady stuff, a little bit headier than the biology, but some exciting new things I'm working on.
I definitely enjoy the mathematics part, but even as you were saying about if everything came from math, but at the end of the day, math is information. And so there has to be something to be able to process that information and to be aware of that information. I mean, we might be able to describe, and that's what mathematics is.
That's what math does. It describes realities, but math by itself does not create or generate anything.
Exactly.
And to say otherwise is a fallacy that philosophers call the fallacy of reification, imputing substantial causal powers to a mere abstract concept. To say that the math of quantum physics caused our universe to come into existence would be a little bit like saying the latitude and longitude lines on the map caused the Himalayan mountains to rise. No, they describe where the Himalayan mountains are, perhaps. We might even have some other way of describing how tall they are. But our descriptions, our mathematical descriptions, do not cause things to happen in the real world. To say otherwise is to impute what philosophers call ontology to math, to impute as if the math had a real existence and also an existence that is capable of causal power that we know it doesn't have. If math does have real existence, it, in our experience, always exists in a mind. Mm-hmm. And so Alexander Vilenkin, mm-hmm. one of the quantum cosmologists, had a telling passage in his book where he's describing all of this. And he says, well, if we're saying that the universe began from these laws of quantum physics, on what tablets were these laws written? Before there's matter, space, time, or energy, where did the laws of physics reside if they're purely mathematical? And we know that math typically resides in minds, well, then are we saying that a mind preceded the origin of the universe? So that was one of the two implications that I explored. One of the two problems I explored was the idea that quantum cosmology can explain the origin of the universe without recourse to an intelligent creator. And then the second thing, as I mentioned, was that, and on the board, you may remember that I had the Schrodinger equation in the PowerPoint slides. I had the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is the analog of the Schrodinger equation when we're talking about the origin of the universe itself, when we're talking about quantum cosmology. But rather than write out that equation again, I just put big, hairy equation. And the flow chart in the lecture was that I described. This is how the mathematical procedure of the quantum cosmologists. They have a universe they want to explain. They will say they've explained it if the universe is an outcome of what's called the universal wave function. And that function describes all the possible universes that could exist with different gravitational fields. But to get to the universal wave function, there's a prior equation that has to be solved, and it's a functional differential equation that has an infinite number of solutions, unless the physicist or the mathematician chooses highly restrictive, what are called boundary conditions, to limit the degrees of mathematical freedom of that equation so that you get one solution, which would be a function that would include our universe as a possibility. But solving that equation without the imposition of those boundary constraints, without imposing restrictions on degrees of mathematical freedom, is impossible. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think what's really being modeled is the need for an input of information to get the specificity you would need to build a universe like ours. And that, I think, is another argument for intelligent design. Because even in the modeling that the mathematicians did, the restriction of those degrees of mathematical freedom came from the intelligence of the theoretical physicist.
That's all the time we have for this episode. On another episode, we will continue this conversation and discuss further with Dr. Meyer about the questions that were asked by students at the seminar, as well as his new upcoming book, For ID the Future. I'm Beatrice Rusu. Thank you for listening.
From jumping insects with real gears to the strange world of carnivorous plants, the details of the natural world reveal planning and purpose. In his new book, Foresight, Brazilian scientist Marcos Eberlin shows how the mantis shrimp can pack a deadly punch and how a tiny protein in a bird's eye may work just like a GPS. You can join Marcos Eberlin as he uncovers a myriad of artful solutions to major engineering problems in chemistry and biology. Find out how these solutions point beyond blind evolution and point instead to the designing ability of a mind, and a mind with foresight. Order on Amazon or visit DiscoveryInstitutePress.com to get your own copy of the book Foresight. Get Eberlin's new book from Amazon or at DiscoveryInstitutePress.com/foresight.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.